This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Today on the show, we've got jobs, consumer spending, and a look into the process of making the dollars and cents we spend. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In New York, I'm Kristen Schwab, in for Kai Rizdal. It's Thursday, October 19th. Good to have you with us. Today, we start with jobs and the resilience of the job market. It's something that's defined this era of inflation, despite the Federal Reserve raising interest rates. Jobless claims data from the Department of Labor shows the number of people filing for first-time unemployment last week hit a nine-month low. Now, I know we've said this many, many times before, that the labor market is tight, it keeps getting tighter, and seems kind of unstoppable. But as Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino reports, there's some nuances in the data that might tell a different story.
These unexpectedly low initial jobless claims come after unexpectedly big job gains in September. Unemployment is now near historic lows, and layoffs and firings have been rarer than they were before the pandemic. But
that doesn't mean that the Fed's interest rate hikes are having no effect on the labor market.
Julia Pollack is chief economist at job site ZipRecruiter. She says continuing claims among people who've been on unemployment more than a week, those jumped more than expected, which could mean it's now harder to land a job.
And that suggests that the Fed's rate hikes are affecting the labor market by slowing hiring, not by causing layoffs.
One factor could be a bit of a hangover among employers after the extreme staffing shortages of the past couple years, says Aaron Sojourner, a senior researcher at the Upjohn Institute.
They realize it's expensive to hire, it's expensive to onboard, it's expensive to train and integrate people in their operation.
So companies may be wary of letting go of employees, even if they are feeling uncertain about the economy, says Lydia Boussour, senior economist at EY Parthenon.
We are seeing some labor hoarding and companies holding on to their workers that they had such a hard time hiring in the first place.
But an increase in layoffs could be on the way. There's been an uptick in notices under the WARN Act, which requires large employers to give workers and local officials 60 days' notice if they're planning big job cuts. Aaron Terrazas is chief economist at job site Glassdoor.
Some of what we might be seeing in the WARN data is growing kind of bankruptcy fears.
He says that could be related to ongoing strikes, like the United Auto Workers one, which will presumably resolve, or just businesses feeling the squeeze of higher interest rates, which are probably going to stick around. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Wall Street today ended on a sour note again. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Let's move from an unstoppable job market to seemingly unstoppable consumers who, more than 3 years after pandemic lockdowns, are still spending like crazy, and not just on necessities, but fun. Americans are on track to spend nearly 25% more on live events this year, thanks in part to Beyonce, Bruce Springsteen, and Taylor Swift. Yet, according to a new survey by Credit Karma, more than half of Americans say they're going to cut back on entertainment because of rising costs. So is this one of those cases where we believe what people say about spending or what they do? Here's Marketplace's Matt Levin.
18-year-old Dylan Kay is not proud of how much it cost him to see the pop punk band Blink 182 reunite in Cleveland earlier this year.
I actually paid an embarrassing amount for tickets. I paid $400. Yeah, $400, not even for pit tickets. It was like seats decently close to the pit, but not quite there.
That doesn't even include the $100 Kay spent on gas for the 3-hour drive from rural Ohio. Kay says it was totally worth it. He loves Blink, and the pyrotechnics were apparently pretty sweet. But would he pay that much for another Blink concert in the future?
No. I've got that out of my system. If they came around for like $100 maybe, but $400 for Blink again, no.
That I got it out of my system feeling, that's especially true for fans catching older artists who might be on their final tour. USC marketing professor Stephanie Tully forked over $250 for Elton John tickets. She couldn't actually get a great view of Elton all that well from her seat, but...
Now I can say that I have seen him, right? And so it's that feeling of, if I don't do it now, I'm never going to get to do this. And we know that consumers respond very strongly to scarcity.
But consumers can only YOLO their way through very high ticket prices for so long, says Jason Mercer at Moody's Investor Service.
This is not a sustainable economic phenomenon that's happening. The inflation prices are well above what's what we're seeing, even in the general economy.
But while concert prices may eventually calm down, Mercer says the pandemic may have just given consumers a permanently bigger appetite to spend on live events. Pediatric nurse Courtney Daniels says she's paid well over $400 for Brandi Carlile shows around the country this year.
Would it have been better used to make a payment on pre-existing debt? Maybe, but I also decided to spend it on this instead.
Daniel says there's just something special and communal about being there live with the Bramily. That's what Brandi Carlile fans call themselves. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
There are a lot of nuances to why consumer spending keeps chugging along. Here's one potential reason. According to the Fed's survey of consumer finances that came out this week, American households saw a record 37% rise in net worth between 2019 and 2022. That trend was particularly pronounced among Black households, whose wealth grew by 61%, and Hispanic households, whose wealth grew by 47%. Marketplace's Savannah Marr has more on what that might mean for our country's big, stubborn wealth gap.
Most of that broad increase in American households' net worth can be explained by one asset, says senior economist Kayla Bruhn with Morning Consult.
You know, home values went up a lot 2019 to 2022.
But there wasn't a significant surge in Black or Hispanic homeownership during the pandemic. So why did those two groups' wealth grow so much faster than white and Asian households? Bruhn points to the pandemic labor market.
Jobs growth was increasingly benefiting sort of those lower wage sectors because that's where more of the recovery was still taking place from the pandemic, things like leisure and hospitality and food service.
Sectors where Black and Hispanic workers are overrepresented. Joanne Hsu, an economist at the University of Michigan, sees another explanation.
We also see increases in stock market participation for those two groups as well,
allowing them to benefit when the markets rebounded from the brief pandemic recession in 2020. But some of the recent growth in Black and Hispanic wealth is a bit of an illusion. Since those households started with less wealth, small changes have a larger impact. And the Fed's report points out that despite faster wealth growth, the absolute dollar value between Black and Hispanic households' wealth and white households' wealth actually got wider during the pandemic.
What we are seeing is the legacy of historical racism, discrimination, and redlining.
That's Vanessa Perry with the Urban Institute's Housing Finance Policy Center. And she says current economic conditions won't help us make inroads.
In fact, the homeownership rates were suppressed by the very appreciation that we're talking about.
Which, she says, could help explain another of the Fed survey's findings, that Black and Hispanic households felt more uncertain about their future finances. I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
Megan McCarty-Carino was telling us about the tight labor market earlier. And while that tightness, it's more extreme in some places than others. Take San Juan County, Washington. It's a small chain of islands a few hours north of Seattle, where there are plenty of vacationers, but not enough job applicants. So starting this month, the county is trying an idea that's been gaining momentum in the American workforce. It's actually one of the demands striking auto workers are bargaining for. A 32-hour work week over 4 days at full 40-hour pay. Scott Greenstone from KNKX has the story from Washington on what workers are doing with their extra time.
From the driver's seat of a yellow school bus, Matthew Stewart is training for his newest side hustle, substitute bus driver for the school district on Orcas Island. It's in the San Juans, a series of lush, forested islands popular with vacationers. A steward stops the bus in a neighborhood, an instructor reminds him what to do.
Open your door.
Stay quiet. Quiet on the bus.
Once he's certified as a bus driver, Stewart will then have 3 jobs, and that's common here. The San Juans are a haven for the wealthy. Almost 40% of homes here are vacation or second homes. For everyone else, the cost of living is very high. There's a saying on the islands. Everyone either has 3 homes or 3 jobs.
I topped out at 5 jobs at a time.
Stewart plans to squeeze his hours as a bus driver in between also working for the YMCA and his main gig, maintenance worker for San Juan County.
I should make a list of...
The morning after his bus training, he goes through his to-do list for his county job.
Every 3 months, I clean air filters.
He jumps into his work van to make his way from his office, which, by the way, is in the same building as the local senior center, to the public works shop to replace the air filter. Stewart came to Orcas Island a decade ago to lead sailing trips for kids and stayed because he loves the close-knit community. He often sees people he knows.
Who is that? That is Jason Gross. He's a sheriff's deputy.
About 18,000 people live on the islands year-round, and since the pandemic, the labor shortage has hit hard here. Restaurants have closed or cut hours. Often, the crucial inner island ferries are canceled because there aren't enough workers for the boats. Before the new 32-hour work week, San Juan County had upwards of 30 open jobs with 0 applicants, sometimes for months.
Bringing in new people was difficult because they could be out in the private sector for making so much more money.
Cindy Wolf is the chair of the San Juan County Council.
We were hurting because we were competing with that.
County leaders thought if we can pay workers about the same for 32 hours instead of 40, that's a huge per-hour raise. When workers have a full extra day off each week, sometimes they take on side jobs, but a recent study shows more often people spend that time taking care of their kids. That's especially helpful here on the islands, where childcare is expensive and limited.
There is one daycare on the island that will take children from the age of 1.
Frances Robertson is a marine biologist for the county and lives on the main island, San Juan. She's also the vice president of the local employee union, which applauds the shorter work week. Robertson was lucky enough to get her kids into the 1 local daycare that's open from 8:30 to 5:30, but it's still limited childcare.
They're open 4 days a week, so they're not even open 5 days a week.
She will have some family help for her 5 and 2-year-old on the day the center is closed, so she plans to spend her newfound time doing what she loves, studying whales. It's a regular thing to see them on the way to work or on an afternoon walk, like today. From a hill above the coastline, Robertson points to an orca mother and calf that suddenly surface in the water just yards from the beach.
There they are. Yeah. This is pretty cool, hey?
Wow, they're so close.
They are so close. So that's pretty typical behavior of transient killer whales. They come in pretty close.
Robertson says the cost of living can make this a challenging place to live. But you also don't have to look far to see what makes it worth it. in the San Juan Islands, I'm Scott Greenstone for Marketplace.
Coming up,
we get to draw designs and we get to do sculptures all day.
Money isn't just currency, it's also art. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dipped 250 points, 0.7%, to close at 33,414. The NASDAQ lost 128 points, 1%, to finish at 13,186. And the S&P 500 slid 36 points, 0.8%, to end at 4278. The latest report from the National Association of Realtors shows home sales in September fell to the lowest level since the Great Recession. And the median price for existing homes was $394,000, a record high for September. We heard Matt Levin talking about rising prices for live events, so let's take a look at entertainment stocks. Madison Square Garden Sports Corp dwindled 1.25%. Live Nation Entertainment sunk 2.5%. Sphere Entertainment, the company that puts on concerts in a giant sphere in Vegas, its share sunk 2.6%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 4.99%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kristen Schwab. A lot of the discussion around the trafficking of drugs and people over the U.S.-Mexico border is about them moving north. But there's also a market for goods moving south. About 70% of guns in Mexico come from the United States. We're actually one of the top manufacturers. So recently, the U.S. has been cracking down on its flow of arms to Mexico. But as Marketplace's Elizabeth Troval reports, it's not easy to shut down an underground supply chain.
In Houston this summer, government officials in suits piled into a gray meeting room for a press conference. Several large guns were laid out on a table. Fred Milanowski was there with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives.
And this is an M4 U.S. manufactured with a grenade launcher on the front. And this is a 50 caliber rifle.
These are some of the Mexican cartel's favorite weapons to fight off law enforcement and other criminal groups, almost all easy to buy in the United States.
Automatic. You can get a semi-automatic version of this and semi-automatic versions of all those. Yes, so this is legal in the United States to purchase.
Craig Larrabee with Homeland Security Investigations told me it's part of an underground supply chain.
You'll have somebody make a purchase from whether it be like a gun shop or a gun show or a person-to-person sale.
Typically, a U.S. citizen will make that initial purchase on behalf of a criminal organization. This is what's called a straw purchase. Some weapons cost $10,000, $12,000.
Now, sometimes they'll go to stash houses where they sit in a either somebody's house or maybe they'll sit in a storage unit.
From the stash house, someone else will pick them up in a vehicle, hide them.
And then they'll be smuggled across and sent to the purchaser down in Mexico.
Larrabee says sales used to go down a couple guns at a time, but in recent years, the trade has become more sophisticated.
We're seeing larger loads of firearms being smuggled at one time, which is indicative of a more of an organizational approach to the firearm smuggling.
As the Biden administration faces mounting political pressure to better control what and who crosses the border, the U.S. has ramped up efforts to stop the southbound flow of weapons, collaborating more across U.S. agencies and with government officials in Mexico to trace guns, and upping penalties for buying weapons for third parties. U.S. officials, including Attorney General Merrick Garland, touted their efforts at a bilateral security summit in Mexico City earlier this month.
Just last month, we charged and arrested 7 defendants in Texas for buying over 100 guns later trafficked to Mexico.
But there are a lot of challenges to stamping out this trade, says Mark Unger with City University of New York. Corruption in Mexico, limited agency capacity, gaps in gun tracing data sharing, and insufficient data quality, and a lack of understanding of the full scope of this massive global supply chain.
By focusing on the U.S.-Mexico border, they're getting at the hotspot nexus of where that really counts.
But that's only part of this larger picture of the flow of weapons.
Weapons that are essential for the cartels to run their businesses. Here's Larrabee again.
They control their routes through firearms. So it's vital for their ability to stay in power and control those areas for the smuggling of people, for the smuggling of narcotics, for the extortion schemes, for all the different things that they do to terrorize the communities in Mexico.
That violence is what spurred Josefina de Leon to flee her home in the northern Mexican state of Tamaulipas. She's been an advocate for crime victims since her daughter went missing there more than 10 years ago. She says in Mexico, a country with strict gun laws for civilians, it's become easier to get guns. And gun violence has become common not just for cartels, but even within families. It's a big industry with many interests, she says. Interests that don't include whether people die or disappear. In Houston, I'm Elizabeth Trovall for Marketplace.
Next week, the U.S. Mint is releasing a new quarter as part of its series celebrating American women. The design features Maria Tallchief, a member of the Osage Nation, who's considered our country's first prima ballerina. But before a performance artist like Tallchief makes it into a coin, an artist of a different kind dreams it up. From the team at Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids, here's a peek into how money is designed.
My name is Renata Gordon, and I'm a medallic artist at the U.S. Mint in Philadelphia. We work in a beautiful little art studio. We get to draw designs, and we get to do sculptures all day. Designing is different each time. We might have to draw a picture of a very famous person, and it has to look exactly like them. They also might give us an idea, something that is very emblematic of our country. One such idea they gave us was life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It was a 3-coin series. For that particular program, my pursuit of happiness was an archer, and he was drawing back his bow because he was in pursuit of something. Happiness was very simple. My design was a woman letting a bird go in a really beautiful fashion. And life was a tree. Beautiful designs were selected for that program. It wasn't mine. Myself and the other artists in the office always want to see the best design win, even if we think it is someone else's. The most challenging aspect of being U.S. Mint engraver is getting your vision, your beautiful idea, and getting it to be that coin at the very end. Every little feature on the face, every little branch of a tree, and every little window on every piece of architecture has to be just right. It has to come up just the right height off of the flat part of the coin, which we call the basin. After it goes through all those edits, all those really technical challenges that we have in turning it into a coin, all of those machines stamping all of those coins, and yet you still want it to look like what you originally thought of, what you really wanted it to be.
That's Renata Gordon, a designer at the U.S. Mint. You can catch up on the new season of Million Bazillion on the podcast platform of your choice. This final note on the way out, Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell spoke earlier today at the Economic Club of New York. Here's what he had to say about the strong job market despite high interest rates.
We are attentive to recent data showing the resilience of economic growth and demand for labor. Additional evidence of persistently above trend growth, or that tightness in the labor market is no longer easing, could put further progress on inflation at risk and could warrant further tightening of policy.
We'll see what happens at the next Fed meeting in a couple weeks, October 31st and November 1st. Here's your moment of economic context on the way out today about the madness that is airplane boarding. The New York Times got a hold of an internal memo from United Airlines that says it plans to change how it boards the economy cabin. Window seat ticket holders will board the plane first, followed by middle seats, then aisle seats, to cut down on boarding time, which I guess is cool because I'm a window seat girl. You know what it probably won't cut down on? My absolute biggest travel pet peeve, which is the giant, messy mass of people who stand right in front of the gate during boarding, even when they're in Group D. John Buckley, John Gordon, Rick Carr, Diantha Parker, Amanda Peacher, and Stephanie Seek are the Marketplace editing staff. Amir Babawi is the managing editor, and I'm Kristen Schwab. We'll be back tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.